Today is Thursday. It's June 24th, 2021. It's 1:45 in the afternoon. Hi, I'm John Williams. This is The Mincing Rascals, a podcast we record on Thursdays. You can listen for me weekdays on WGN Radio from 9 to noon.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Brandon Pope from WCIU and Ebony Magazine.
And I'm Eric Zorn for One More Day, a columnist at the Chicago Tribune.
So you have one more column to write, or have you already written it?
I've got one more column to write. It'll run on Sunday, sort of saying goodbye to my readers, and then I'm going to be a full-time mincing rascal.
So have you written the column, though? Do you know what you're going to say? Do you have it on file already?
Oh, yeah. I'm pretty much done with it. I'm just sort of fine-tuning it. Want to make sure I don't say the wrong thing. Want to make sure I say all the right things. And it's really tough because Mary Schmeek wrote what I consider to be like the definitive farewell column a week ago. And there's been a raft of farewell columns in our pages, you know, in the last 2 weeks. But trying to follow Mary's is just really a daunting challenge. Hmm. She knocked that out of the park. And I heard your interview with her yesterday on your show. And you can kind of tell why everybody loves Mary Schmeek. She was, she's really something else. And so trying to put as much distance between her final column and mine as possible.
Darlene's final column appeared, I think, today, right, in print?
Yes, and it was very good as well.
You know, I thought, God bless him, John Cass's final column was one of his best columns. My observation, guys, maybe you could chime in on this, is that one of the common threads is how braggadocious you all aren't. Everybody in town is going to miss you. You are the voices of Chicago. We value you greatly, and you guys aren't saying what great stuff you did or here's my greatest column and stuff. It's very much of the people. You guys have been turning the page on the readers and talking about what this is what Mary did and what a lot of you are doing, you know, what I've gained from you doing this job. Boy, that better be your column, Eric, because otherwise.
Yeah, now that you say that, I better take all the bragging out of my last column. No, it really is. All these media jobs, and it's like it. In radio too, right? It's like it's about the relationship you have with your audience. And that is really important. And Mary put that really well. Darlene did. You know, like I said, this is a tough act to follow because so many people have said so many eloquent things. So maybe I should just get out all the stuff about my colleagues and everybody else and just focus on my own accomplishments.
Well, that's very Chicago, though. I feel like that's a function of being ground down by Chicago readership over decades of people being allergic to pretension and having this sort of like tallest tree syndrome where if anyone gets too full of themselves, you get checked pretty quick.
Although, you know, the lesson of Hollywood is to be as vain and arrogant as possible to get attention drawn to yourself. I think that's probably the lesson of Donald Trump, right? Trump never admitted any doubt, never admitted any weaknesses, and look where he ended up.
You and Heidi and everyone there deserves a Kobe Bryant-esque farewell tour, because we already know you're going to drop, 80 points in this final outing here. So, I salute you all, because this is a tough thing for sure. And it's been, like you said, we're seeing some amazing, amazing final pieces. I have no doubt yours is going to match up to that level too.
But that's, you know what, Brandon, that's the thing I was thinking about for some of them. That's why I asked Eric about it, as he already got it written, because I would weigh those words so carefully. You know, I want to say something profound. I don't want to get too far out over my skis, blah, blah, blah. I've done farewell broadcasts, and they're never as profound as I wanted them to be, you know?
You're lucky if you've done farewell broadcasts, John. So many people in your industry, after your shift is over, they call you into the manager's office and they say, can you pack up your things? That was your last shift.
Oh, I've witnessed that where Steve Cochran walked out of the studio doing his morning show and standing there as the program director and the general manager, literally standing on the other side of the door. You open up the door after your show and you go, oh, hello. And you know that's it. That was your last. You just closed the door literally on your last show. They hardly ever let you write a farewell column, if you will.
Right, and it's been really gratifying to see that they have not told us not to write these columns, because there have been a whole – Georgia Garvey had one today. Georgia writes a suburban column. And of course, you mentioned Heidi. Steve Chapman had a very subdued farewell because he's going to be coming back writing for the Syndicate in the Tribune. So he writes for Creator Syndicate. And those columns will appear fairly soon.
Yeah. So, but you all aren't dumping. But the thing, the reason they say that's your last broadcast, because they don't want you to go back on the air and say, these bums, this lousy radio station, boycott the advertisers. I guess you could write a column like that if you wanted, right?
They would not print that. nor would I say that. I mean, one of the things that we've all been saying is that we're urging people who are upset about this, and frankly, some of us are very upset about it. I don't want to leave. It's not on my timetable that I'm leaving, but I do really want people to stay with the Tribune. I want them to keep supporting the colleagues who are left behind. I want I'm hoping for the best for them. I know that this involves some sort of mental gymnastics on some people's part, like they're supporting this organization that has said goodbye to so many people that they are fond of. But there are a ton of great journalists, editors, photographers, writers, designers who are left behind trying to put out a paper, and they really need the support now. And not only do they need the support, but this city needs to have a strong Chicago Tribune. And it needs to have a strong Sun Times. It needs to have a strong Cranes. It needs to have strong TV and radio stations. You see all the stuff that politicians get away with now. And if we have less coverage, fewer watchdogs, we're going to be in more trouble.
How would you feel if a Brandon Pope took your place? You know, not your place per se, but I mean, what if they went to an Austin Berg and a Brandon Pope, two well-known, very good writers, articulate voices in the city? Austin's guest columned before. What if they said, listen, for half the price or pick a number, Austin, you're the new Eric Zorn. Would you begrudge him that?
This is so awkward, John.
I want to say, not at all. I mean, I think.
Why, Austin, have they? What Austin are you looking at?
Has all
no,
the
no one's. No, it's not.
No. Austin has all. You guys have all the chops you'd need to do this kind of work and could contribute to the conversation. Absolutely. I just don't know if there's going to be a budget for that kind of those kind of positions anymore. Yeah, people there definitely will come. The Tribune's been going for 174 years, most of them without me. And I hope it'll go on for another 174, again without me. And you're going to have other voices coming in and filling in. I don't know how big it's going to be. I don't know how many voices like that they're going to have on the payroll and how many are going to be just freelance talent. I think there are probably going to be more opportunities, Austin and Brandon and John, if you want to jump in.
Well, that's what that question was really about.
To write guest op-eds.
It wasn't about that for my case at all, but I will just tell you that as a broadcaster, when they do close the door on your last show, you know that all of your friends in the market now want your show and they will take it from you. And you have to say, well, if Brandon didn't take it, Austin would take it. Somebody's got to take the jobs. You know, I've been in that position before.
I would love it if people I respected and liked took the job. I mean, that would be fabulous.
You know, and that's what happened to me one time. Pardon me for making this all about me now. But then, so they fired me. Or what was it? I got moved to a midnights. Still got a job. But the guy that replaced me was the antithesis of me. It was kind of a right-wing, table-pounding, intellectual politics talker. And I was glad in a way because I thought if you went with a different version of me, then I would have thought I wasn't good enough at it. But they were singing a different song, you know, when they replaced me. So at least I thought, okay, I can't do that. You guys, if that's what you want, fine. Fire me. I'll quit. I cannot do that.
I had a mentor who told me once that when I was young, he was like, your journalism career doesn't start until after you get fired or laid off.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, wow. Talk about pessimistic. But, hey, that's how sadly this industry is right now. We're in a really, really bad state. And so I'm just hoping that voices continue to be uplifted. And people are celebrated over profits because this is noble work. Journalism is about the people, about our communities.
And it's an honor. You know, it's a privilege. Yeah. I mean, that was the thing I grew up believing in, was that there are only so many microphones. There's only so much space in the first section of the Tribune. If you get to write or talk there, honor that, respect that.
Everybody wants a platform. And honestly, too many people at this point with social media have a bit of a platform, but these platforms are really special.
Yeah.
So we do have to cherish them.
Mary Schmidt gave a speech about 6 years ago to a convocation of newspaper columnists. And she ended it this way. She said, when the day comes that you're not a columnist anymore, you'll realize you never were. You were just a person who got to type out some thoughts on some things you cared about, who had the great privilege of some readers who cared enough to read them. And that's really, you know, that's what it is. It's like, it is, as John said, it's a privilege. It's an opportunity to interact with people, to share your thoughts. And there will always be people with thoughts to share them. And you know, life goes on. The paper goes on. I'm sorry that my role in it is ending when it is, because I would have liked to hang on a little longer. But it'll be fine. I'll have the Mincing Rascals to vent all my opinions. We're going to have to make it like a 3-hour show so I can go through every thought I have during the week.
At this rate, we're about to hit the 3-hour mark. Let's get rolling then for today. In February of 2019, Chicago police botched a raid. They burst into the apartment of not a drug dealer, but of a social worker named Anjanette Young. The words, I looked at the video again today, faith, hope, and love adorned her living room wall. And as she stood there, naked, she screamed at the police for over 40 minutes that they had the wrong place. They barely acknowledge her, and it is a safe bet to say the city's going to pay a large price for that mistake. At yesterday's city council meeting, the mayor sought approval of a new corporate council. But aldermen, angry at the city's dragging their heels on the Anjanette Young settlement, got in the way of the mayor's appointment. And little was accomplished at this meeting. The mayor actually got up off the dais, walked over, pointed her finger at one of the aldermen. They had it out in the right in front of everybody. And we still don't have Lakeshore Drive's vote up or down or compromise yet, although by the time you're listening to this, that will probably be resolved. Alderman Riley told us today that the city's going to pay, but should let the lawyers continue to hammer out a settlement with Ms. Young. There's a lot there. Austin, what's the first takeaway for you?
There's a bunch of takeaways from this. The first is we have to consider that it's usually a good thing for there to be open debate and even maybe anger and anger spilling out when it comes to democracy. Democracy's messy. It's okay if people are arguing about things. The question always becomes, though, in Chicago is what are they arguing about, and does it actually matter? And the problem structurally with city council, as I've said before, is you need to get the mayor out of the council and you need to get the council members out of their ward operations. And what we saw was this sort of this clown show circus in council, part of which was sort of ignited by the mayor going out of Robert's Rules of Order, trying to appoint her corp council. And the mayor, essentially, you see in Chicago, it's one of the only large cities where the mayor is even in that role of presiding over the legislature. And it's really concerning when it comes to checks and balances that you have the executive doing that over the legislature. And you will inevitably get stuff like this pop up every once in a while. Typically, the city council is a complete rubber stamp because of all of the power the mayor has. But because due to her dwindling political capital and lots of events outside of her control, she doesn't have control over the council right now. So that's why you're seeing these sorts of flare-ups. The second thing I would say is in regard to the corporation council, the city council, it's unclear if there was any kind of noble aim in rejecting the nomination of that corp council. It was ostensibly just to mess with Lightfoot. But they have a legitimate case that the corp council's office is poorly set up. And it's poorly set up because that office historically essentially just serves the mayor's interests. And when city council members need legal guidance or assistance, they have to go to the big boss, the mayor, and a corporation council that's loyal to her to get any kind of help or advice. Los Angeles deals with that by having an elected city attorney, which I think is something Chicago should consider. But remember, the reason the corp council's office was vacant in the first place is because Mark Flessner, the last corp council, was run out of town for essentially trying to hide the video that you were just talking about. And that was in the mayor's interests to do. So two things, corp council, too much is too beholden to the mayor.
Yeah.
Mayor should not be presiding over city council.
I had a couple of other takeaway thoughts on this. First of all, it's the job of the city's law department to attempt to negotiate the best settlement that they can when there's a lawsuit against the city, as there is in the Anjanette Young case. It's not their job to just open up the city's wallet and say, pay her whatever she wants. Now, there's this, it seems to be this sense on the council that they are on Anjanette Young's side on the legal matter. And the city council is a steward of our money. This is not their money. This is the taxpayers' money. And the Corporation Council is trying to work out a settlement. And I guess they're dragging their feet. I guess it's been a slow process, maybe too slow. But this is what you do. They're trying to get a settlement that is responsible to the taxpayers. That is what we should be paying to her. Because again, this is not funny money. This is our money that we're going to give to this woman for this outrageous thing that happened to her. So I don't think it's necessarily outrageous that the city is trying to negotiate a good settlement on this. But the second thing that I saw here was that, you know, the two councilmen decided that they were going, you know, Taylor and Lopez said that they wanted to defer the nomination of Celia Meza for Corporation Council. Now, it was completely a symbolic move because her confirmation is assured. They were just yanking her chain. And so what Lightfoot could have done, should have done, is just she could have just said, okay, fine, gaveled the meeting to the close and say, well, we'll meet again on Friday so we can consider this nomination. Instead, Lightfoot just takes the bait. She just lunges at every provocation. She goes to the back of the council chamber. She gets in the face of Alderman Taylor. For what? What is she trying to prove? Why this woman is supposed to be the mayor of the city, and she's acting like they're acting like school children, and she's got to have the leadership chops just to say, okay, you've done that, you're yanking my chain, we're, you know, meeting, gavel a meeting to a close, we'll come back in 2 days and confirm her and get going on it. I did not understand her tactic here at all.
The aldermen are playing from a political advantage point here because it's tough to put a price point on someone's dignity. And so when we're talking settlements, and you talk about this corporate council being accountable to the people, this Anjanette Young case just rattled people, not just in Chicago, but around the country. And so the 1 million number that was put out there, who can really say whether that is right, whether that's enough? The only person that can really tell you that is Anjanette Young, who went through it. So, politically, the aldermen are coming from the political kind of like advantage here, because I think most constituents probably saw that and think, yeah, you got to do something here to make this right. But you do have to be responsible to the taxpayer. So there's that angle of it. I look at this whole clown show that we saw with City Hall. This is the environment that Lightfoot created. She created it during the campaign. She created it when at her inauguration that I was there for.
Yeah.
She turned around to all the aldermen and basically said, we're taking you out. She's created this in the way she handles her relationships with these aldermen. Even her own supposed allies are frosty on her. Now, people had issues with Rahm Emanuel. Even progressive aldermen did. But every progressive alderman I talk to, they say, well, at least Rahm Emanuel took a meeting. At least he picked up the phone when I called. At least he would tell me to my face that he doesn't like what I'm saying or, you know, what I'm doing, or we'd had disagreements here and there. And with Lightfoot, it's a different angle because she doesn't feel like she needs these aldermen at all. She sees them as a formality. And the truth is, the way Chicago politics is set up, you got to work in lockstep. You got to have some sort of cohesion. So the animosity has been building for so long. The only person to really blame for it is Lightfoot in the end, because she's the one that is the chief in smoothing over these relations. And she's time after time after time again shown she doesn't want to or has no interest in doing so.
I think some people like, though, that she got off the dais, walked right up. I mean, I heard from listeners who liked it. Is what it is. That is Lori Lightfoot.
But why does she take the bait? I mean, they were just yanking her chain. That's all they're doing. They're not, you know, she's like carrying on like, oh, they're trying to deny a woman of color a position of power. Like, that wasn't what they were doing. She knows that's not what they're doing. She knows they're just trying to get a rise out of her, and they did. And she ends up looking petulant and thin-skinned and immature. I just don't get it. Looks like she doesn't know how to exercise authority. You say some people like this, John. I don't know who those people would be, and I would have words with them.
I think it's a lot different when you're standing up to literally a cartoon villain of Ed Burke and saying, "You're out of order, Mr. Burke." And everyone's like, "Yeah, someone finally said it to Ed Burke." When you're going toe-to-toe with someone like Alderman Taylor, who most Chicagoans may not know, those who do know her probably like her, and her brand is to be, you know, a truth teller and kind of like a bomb thrower and very, very honest and outspoken about how she feels. So I don't think Lightfoot did look good there. The other thing underlying all of this, though, between Lightfoot and Alderman is you have to remember, and the Tribune did great reporting on this just recently, Lightfoot came in on basically two platforms. One was on corruption and one was on police reform. And a lot of aldermen were elected on a platform of police reform as well. And it's 2 years into her administration. And that the too long didn't read of that Tribune piece is nothing's been done. Lightfoot didn't even have her own ordinance for a civilian and police oversight committee until it was the last second and aldermen were finally growing enough of a backbone to maybe push it through. She then introduces her own proposal. This was last week, and kind of nukes both of them at the same time. So I think under all of this is extraordinary frustration, unprecedented frustration in her tenure over that issue of police oversight. Now there's been no progress.
Well, don't you all think, though, that against the backdrop of all of the problems the city has, economics, violence, that to see them playing tit for tat, like Eric, you say, why did she take the bait? And I think because she resents the ploy. We've got work to do here, and you guys are playing these clown games when, in fact, we're trying to get businesses to open back up in the city. We're trying to curtail violence, and we got to go through this crap. I think that was maybe the basis for her reaction. That had to be part of it, right?
The problem is both sides are right, unfortunately. Like, the Lightfoot administration has serious governance flaws. The city council is also not equipped to govern the city of Chicago. These are ward bosses concerned with potholes in their neighborhood, awnings, sidewalk cafes. They are not equipped to study issues. They're not equipped to propose great legislation. A lot of them are not qualified. And the problem is, like, you kind of just have two clumsy people just running into each other. And it is sad because there are serious issues that need to be dealt with.
Yeah, when they're not in lockstep, it screws over everybody. The fact that nothing got done in that meeting it's a travesty. It's ridiculous. And it's also a metaphor for Chicago politics and politics in general, what people see in Washington as well. What's getting done? We have all this infighting. It's frustrating. And I wonder how this is all going to shake out. I know we're a little bit of a ways off, but, you know, Lightfoot hasn't announced a re-election yet. But I'm just wondering, looking at what's happened so far in her administration, the combative nature, I do wonder, how is that going to impact how she does? Are people still latching on to that? Are the people that voted for her still in favor of, get her. Yeah, go at her in the back of the chambers. Or are they like some of us who are just by it all, they actually want to see some progress done.
I agree that politics are going to be very interesting with Lightfoot and her reelection chances. And I think we're going to see some hint of where she's going or what her plans are with how she handles this DuSable Lakeshore Drive question as it comes up again tomorrow, Friday, that she can probably veto that initiative to change the name of Lakeshore Drive to DuSable Drive. And she can probably have that veto withstand the necessary 2/3 vote of the council that necessary to overturn that. That veto would probably stand. But does she want to do that? What is her standing right now in the African-American community? If she's fighting with some of these aldermen so strongly, does she need to shore up that support? Or is she just going to say, well, I'm going to throw in my lot with the people who are opposed to this change? And we've seen from polls that most white voters are opposed to the change of the drive of the name of the drive. So is she going to throw her lot in there? I think it'll be an interesting thing to see.
Yeah, I wonder how she's going to play this with black voters, because I can't give anecdotal evidence as like the reason why I feel this, but it is. Most black people I talk to in Chicago are not pro Lightfoot because they see nothing's happening. And the top issue right now two top issues for Black Chicago, especially South and West Side: violence in their neighborhoods and the policing issue. And nothing has been done about that as deaths skyrocket in the city, as you can't even chill outside of your porch in some neighborhoods without having to worry about something breaking out. So for those voters, they're not happy with LIFA right now. And their aldermen, like Anjanette Taylor, they see them as the only ones fighting for them right now.
Are they frustrated by this attention being given to this DuSable drive? I mean, because it doesn't save one life. Yeah. It doesn't stop one policeman from abusing his authority. It seems so, as you know, Brandon, your point is really good, which is like, it just seems so off topic right now. We've got these horrible murders, this shooting at the Puerto Rican Day parade that happened. We've got the woman, the graduate student who was walking over by Union Station and was stabbed to death for apparently no reason whatsoever. And you've got people worried about what we're going to call a street. So
that's a topic that the more well-heeled have the luxury of worrying about. I would imagine on the West and South Side, Brandon, I won't ask you to speak for all of them, but I'll bet that's not a common topic on the streets.
That hasn't come up. I mean, I see it on Twitter, but the refrain on Twitter is what Eric said. Why are we talking about this when we have all these things happening right now that really need top attention?
Well, I think you guys are all forgetting that Chicago has declared racism a public health crisis, and that's really going to move the needle, I think.
There's a win.
I wish that Anjanette Young's this thing had been resolved by now. I mean, it's coming up on 900 days since that botched break-in, right? Why has it taken it this long? I saw the number 2.5 million. I don't know, 3 million. We got to pick a number. Don't give her 100 million. You know, a lot of times when we're trying to resolve what the value is of a police error, it's a shooting, it's a bullet, it's a death, and this isn't that. It's a humiliation. So I don't know how generous you need to be. You do need to be. I guess I'm more perplexed by the amount of time it's taken to resolve this. This isn't a $100 million check. It's a $2 million check. Write the damn thing. Apologize.
We have given less money than that to people who police have actually killed. So, yeah, this was egregious. It was horrible what happened to her. It was a humiliation. But it wasn't. They didn't murder her, which is something.
So we got that going for us.
When you're trying to, and maybe this is what the law department is doing, but they should be doing it because, again, it's not Alderman Taylor's money to give away. It's not Lori Lightfoot's money to give away.
What's the budget for the city of Chicago?
You know that they're giving to this woman.
Would you care? Would you care if it was $10 million versus $6 million or $6 million versus $4 million? Would you say, hey, that's my 87 cents? I mean, I'm more agitated, Eric, by the time it's taking than the amount I'll bet it's going to cost.
These lawsuits always take time, John. This is not
3 years.
About
I mean, really? Here, I mean, right? Well, it doesn't have to. Well, guess what? Then you got 3 years of headaches on this.
I mean, the biggest argument you have for police reform that crosses party lines is this issue right here: how much it's going to cost the taxpayer. Police messing up costs the taxpayer every single time. And Chicago Police Department is one of the top when it comes around the country to lawsuits and things they have to pay out because these things keep happening. So if you want to rally people around a police reform message, talk about the taxes. Talk about the costs. That really is part of the issue.
I mean, John, you're right. A city of what is it, 2-3 million people, each person is on the hook for a small amount of money, but those things do add up over time. That you have all these settlements and all this misbehavior, and it does need to be brought in check. And Brandon is right, and I do think that this is something that needs to be called to the attention of people who feel like this isn't my problem. Police brutality is not my problem. I live in a safe neighborhood, and the police are fairly nice.
Austin, you've paid attention to these tabs before. Haven't you commented on the running total here versus elsewhere?
Yeah, I think it's $500 million over the last decade. $500 million with a B. So it's a significant amount of money. It's more than a lot of other cities. And Brandon is exactly right. There's a work plan in a consent decree that, if followed, will result in a reduction of those costs, and it will result in a decrease in unconstitutional policing, and it's not being implemented.
That consent decree been around, I don't know how long now, and they're still trying to figure out how to implement it. They're celebrating minuscule benchmarks that they're crossing with the consent decree. It should have been resolved by now. That's the frustration.
2014.
And the consent decree has been since that was, you know, the feds got involved. I believe that was 2017. So we've had it for 4 years now.
This is trivial compared to all of that, but I wanted to talk to you about electric scooters for a minute. Do you mind?
Let's do it. I love those.
Go for it. Also, 2017 was the Lisa Madigan lawsuit. 2019 is the consent decree.
So scooters are getting the green light so far in the city. A couple years into a pilot program or two. Electric scooters are popping up in the suburbs as well. I just want to say this about driving in Chicago right now. It is not the challenge so much for the volume of traffic as it is for the type of traffic. You've got scooters and bikes and those motorized skateboards and motorcycles and motorized bicycles, which are amazing. You see somebody coming down the road on a bicycle doing 30 miles an hour, but they got a little propulsion underneath them. Then you got the cars and the joggers and the walkers and the ladies and men with the baby strollers, and they're all looking at their phones. And my wife and I talk about this, and we're driving about. There is still less traffic. It's coming back, but it's like walking through a jungle with all of these gnats and mosquitoes and dragonflies and, you know, armadillos going by. And it's just all these things from all different directions. I don't have a question like, so what are we going to do about it? Except that you add a complication to it when you add scooters, electric scooters, because they're running the red lights just like the bicyclists are a lot of times, too. But the Tribune editorialized that we should continue to allow them. So far this year, 500,000 rides have been taken on those electric scooters in the city, which is, that number surprised me. I guess that's just the way cities are evolving right now, right? Different modes of transportation for different needs as well. And since it's hard to get an Uber or a Lyft these days, we just have to accept that that's what city life is going to look like.
They're not allowed on sidewalks. Is that right?
That's correct. They're not supposed to be, but you'll find them on there. In fact, that's one of the top complaints, is that they pop up on sidewalks as well.
There ought to be severe punishments for people who ride them on sidewalks, in my opinion. But, you know, if they stay where bicycles stay, of course, Austin, you're more of a bicyclist. Do you find that they are a hindrance to you?
I haven't. People, they're usually faster than I'm biking. So it's not like we're not, you know, really running at the same speed most of the time. I think they're a great thing, especially for like a flat city like ours. They're a great thing for like last mile problems, like people who need to get from a train to a bus or from a bus to home. Like they really fill that gap in a way that lots of other transit options don't fill, which is great and increases people's use of public transit. And also Ubers, I don't know if you guys have gotten Ubers lately, but those things are real expensive and they're only going to get more expensive. And I think it's great to have options like this.
It's interesting. I was reading about the Uber problem, why they're so expensive. And one reason that they're expensive is they're having a hard time getting Uber drivers because of the carjacking situation.
Yeah.
That these drivers feel like they're not protected and they're sitting ducks as out in some of these neighborhoods where they're going. And there's carjackings happening, you know, on the Gold Coast. And
they're off 60% drivers. They have 60% fewer drivers right now.
And I don't think it's because of the wages they're being paid. I think it's just because people are afraid to drive these things. And this just ties back into our problem, the crime problem. And the mayor was saying that crime is down and we shouldn't be as worried about it. But I don't think she's right about that, is she? Or is she really just cherry-picking some statistics?
I talk to people outside of Chicago. My family lives in Joliet. I got friends in Minooka. I've met a lot of people lately in Ottawa, Illinois. And the perception of Chicago is carjacking. I won't go on the South and West Side. I'll probably avoid a stray bullet. But the idea that just driving in the city is really terrifying to a lot of people. I got to be honest with you. When I drive through Chicago, pretty much anywhere, but especially if, say, I'm getting on the Skyway and I'm on the, not the far south side, but I'm south of the Loop, as I'm approaching intersections, I pay attention to the distance between me and the cars in front and behind me in case I need an escape route. I never used to think about that. But that perception is very real out there right now.
It's the problem Atlanta has with the, you know, car theft, people breaking into their cars. We're kind of giving that label there. it's so when you have scooters, you kind of avoid that issue, right? I mean, there's so many reasons why scooters work. The Uber conversation, the shortage of drivers is interesting. I was talking with a guy I know who works for Lyft, and he mentioned that one reason why they're having trouble getting drivers is because a lot of drivers they had went into the food delivery area, and they like that a lot better.
And yeah, right. Stay there. Right.
And there's been a big boom in that. And when you think about it, it makes sense. With food, you're not dealing as much with people in your car. With food, you're also getting more tips than you would when people do an Uber or Lyft ride. So I can see why a driver would be like, yeah, I'm just going to stick with Postmates or DoorDash or one of those things.
I don't know. Do you have to identify your car? Because Uber drivers, regular Uber drivers, have the signs on the car telling who they are. It might make them a little bit more obvious. I don't know off the top of my head whether an Uber Eats driver or Lyft mates, those places have signs on their cars saying who they are.
I haven't seen those, but I know that nobody's ever quit because of an obnoxious roast beef sandwich. I've seen people getting into Ubers and Lyfts, and I thought, man, I'm glad I'm not that driver. It's like, welcome to my personal space, man. Wow.
I have seen some of the videos from downtown where kids on divvy bikes will take their bikes and they'll corner regular cyclists and they'll knock them down and they'll take the regular bike and they'll leave them with the divvy bike.
Are you kidding?
So it might be that scooters will become a tool of people who are out doing street crime. You never know.
It's hard to look tough on one of those scooters, I will say. The stance alone that you're required to take makes you look like sort of a show pony.
I'm so biased on scooters because I just love them. Every time I go to DC, I am zipping around on the scooters. And I do think, like what Austin mentioned, they fill those gaps. I'm a guy that doesn't have a car in Chicago. So if I need to go far, I really don't want to have to wait on a bus and then the train and all that. We have lots of gaps like that here in Chicago. New York doesn't really have that. So filling those gaps could help a lot of people. The thing that I think is an issue, you can't really ride them in the loop yet. At least when they did the pilots, you couldn't take them around the loop. And that's probably one of the places where I think people would utilize them the most, trying to get from South Loop to West Loop or something like that.
Just on the topic of public transportation now, now that we're in phase five, so I've been taking the bus a lot lately, but I've also been taking the red line again. I take the brown line sometimes now, too. I forget what day it was. It might have been June 12th, but it was the first time I got onto a crowded L car, and it was really good. Every single person on there had a mask but one guy, and a lot of us were standing holding the rails, and I've had to do that on the buses now, too, on the CTA buses. Not capacity, not where it once was. It's still a fraction of what it was, but it's not all going to come back at once. And you do start to see a little more summertime traffic going to a Cubs game, people coming downtown, people using it for work. When I take the bus to work, it seems like there's more people on it now. It's kind of weird, too, because if you have a bus and it has, say, I don't know, what is it, maybe 20 bench seats, 10 people will sit. And there will always be an empty space. And then sometimes you'll just put your butt on the edge of that seat and promise to breathe down the aisle, everybody's got their masks on. But without even saying a word, you're sort of negotiating air pockets. That's new because prior to that, for a year, you had the whole bus to yourself. A lot of times there's two of us on the bus. I say that's all a good sign. That's a good problem to have right now. And it is safe. The state's positivity rate is 0.9%. 0.9%. And here's another interesting number. Only 0.1% of the people hospitalized with COVID-19 have been vaccinated. Put another way, 99.9% of COVID hospitalizations are people who didn't get the vaccine. Throw that number at the person who says, well, I don't know if the vaccine's a good idea. 99.9% of COVID hospitalizations are unvaccinated people. So, and Illinois is doing pretty well, right? We are about as high as any state. We won't get to 70%, will we, guys, by the 4th of July? But we'll be pert near that for adults vaccinated. So Illinois is doing pretty well. And Chicago's doing pretty well.
It seems to me that if we are not blindsided by the effects of some of these variants and that the vaccine continues to be shown effective against them, that we will be out of this. It feels like we'll be out of it certainly by Thanksgiving, right? I've been at we had a party last week for a lot of the people who were departing. Some of the columnists came over, and everyone was like, it was a completely normal. It was outdoors, but it was a completely normal party. No one was wearing a mask. Everyone was vaccinated, and it just felt so normal. And I feel like we are going to be like I said Thanksgiving, maybe Labor Day, that we're going to go to the grocery store to shop and no one's going to be wearing a mask. We're going to come home, we're going to have the neighbors over, no one's going to be wearing a mask. Everyone will be fine. We've already seen capacity crowds at the stadiums. I wonder what the last things are going to be to get back to normal, but it just feels like life is really speeding back to normal. Maybe a little, maybe too fast, but it definitely feels like it's there.
It feels weird, right? Like I went to the gym today. Nobody's wearing a mask. No, the mask requirement's gone. Grocery store out here in Gold Coast, Julasco, no one's wearing a mask. I'm like the only person. I'm like, I guess I'll take mine off too. I'm vaccinated. But it feels odd because we've been doing this for a year and a half. It feels like longer. It feels like the new way of life. And honestly, I'm probably going to keep a mask around and still wear them, especially during cold and flu season, because when's the last time you got a cold or a flu wearing those masks? It really is. It's helpful all around. Like, we should have done this a long time ago.
The speed of the transition to me is shocking. And I was reading, there's a lot of good sociological research on, it's called the minority rule. And it doesn't have anything to do with like racial minorities. It's just behavior. And there are these tipping points where if 25% of a population, whether it's local, a community, and a family, adopts a certain behavior, it tips the rest of the 75% really quickly. And I think that happened with masks. And I think I've seen it in the last 2 weeks. I was out in Denver, no masks on public transit, like very few of the Uber drivers were having us wear masks. We're at a big wedding and nobody had masks. And it was really weird. And I tweeted this, but you knew it's been a long time since a big wedding, because the bartenders were dancing to September by Earth, Wind, and Fire, which if you are a bartender and in the middle of wedding season, you want to kill yourself.
You're done with that song. Yeah. Again.
Yeah. You're done. So well, yeah. And it's the same thing in Chicago. I feel like it's totally different.
Well, I was at Whole Foods in the People's Republic of Ann Arbor last weekend for my father's 90th birthday, and just about everyone in that store was wearing a mask still, even though the sign out front said if you've been vaccinated, your mask is completely optional. It was, like I say, I would say 95% of the customers were still wearing masks, and I'm not even sure what that's about. I put on a mask because everyone else was. It was just, it felt culturally wrong not to wear a mask. And so I'm wondering if there's just some sort of we're going to be the most cautious group of people in America here. But I mean, Whole Foods in Ann Arbor is very liberal central. So
I'm a hybrid of all of that. Like what you and Brandon were talking about, where the other day I was in Mariano's, and nobody had the masks on except the poor employees. I feel bad for them. It's like, give these people a break. We're all agreeing that if you're vaccinated, you don't have to wear the mask. But I wear the mask into the store, and I'm walking around, and nobody has a mask on. I'm thinking, well, I don't have to either. I've been vaccinated for a long time, and I had the damn disease early in the run, so I'm probably double vaccinated. And so then after a while, I'm like, okay, screw it. I just take my mask off because I don't know why I'm doing it, except that it feels culturally appropriate to do, but I'm the only one doing it. So I end up taking it off halfway through most of my visits to the store. And I'm with you, Brandon. It feels good. It feels good to have that thing off my face. And probably not just the physical good feeling. It feels liberating that way too. We're 13 days in to phase five. They had sellout crowds at Wrigley Field. People are packing in bars and weddings. And the number is still holding, maybe too soon to judge. I don't know. Austin, you haven't seen any reporting that it's trending up radically or quickly.
Not in the United States, no.
No, not even in the United States, huh? Let alone Illinois.
I will say I'm a little bummed, a little annoyed at the vaccine rewards. You know, some of us did what we were supposed to do long time ago. But now, anyone that's late to the game, you get free Lollapalooza tickets. Look at you. How about that? day passes and House of Blues tickets. Congrats on being late to the party. It grinds my gears. Not that I would go to Lollapalooza, but I'd like to have the option of having the reward. I'd like that.
Well, you would take the $1 million if you won. You're automatically registered in that lottery, Brandon. You don't want that?
I mean, yeah, I'll take some of that, obviously. Sure. I just, the chances of all the Illinoisans.
I was giving some of that to Dr. Ngozi Ezike, and she said, well, if you don't want the money, you can give it back. I said, no, I'll probably keep it.
See, my contrary view here is that they should have just reserved this lottery and these rewards for people who hadn't had the vaccine, say, starting June 15th or whatever, and run it through the end of July. Because the whole point of all these rewards is to incentivize people who haven't had the vaccine. I feel like my return to normal life is my reward. And if this money is going to hasten that for everybody and is going to bring an end to this pandemic faster, I'd rather the money be used for that. Wanting your own little bit of this money is like asking for food stamps or something when you don't need them. That's not the purpose. The purpose of food stamps or food assistance is not to give money equally to everybody who might want it it's to shape behaviors, to change things. And that's, if we're going to use this money, we should use it to change things and not worry about fairness. So I say keep Brandon out of Lollapalooza.
Well, what's the saying?
Joining with the kids in that.
I think you're letting perfect be the enemy of good. I mean, it's a flawed concept or procedure, but it did seem to work in Ohio. One other note, just speaking of percentages and numbers here, 83% of Arlington Heights residents want the Bears to move to their town. I thought that Arlington Heights would oddly be an outlier. Like, would you want the Bears in the suburbs? Yeah, but not in my backyard. I want it in my neighbor's backyard. 2/3 of Chicago area residents want the team to leave Soldier Field downtown. Only 18% strongly oppose moving the team. So I'm an outlier on this one, too. I want the team downtown. I want the fans miserable, sitting in the cold weather. I don't care if we have a Super Bowl or host a Final Four. All of those things are on TV for me. I'm happy to watch it on TV. And by the way, I'm not – the Super Bowl is probably something you do want. The Olympics, you don't. But the Super Bowl, you probably do. But we can live without the Super Bowl.
And the Final Four.
Yeah. Well,
and the monster truck rallies.
Here we go again. I like your idea last week, Eric, that if you...
John, I'm so glad this week that you're not king. Because moving the Bears off the lakefront is such a good idea. It's just a TV show for 95% of us. It doesn't matter to me where the Bears play. I haven't been to a Bears game, I don't think, in 15 years. I do like the Bears, but I haven't been. Most people don't go to the games. So wherever they want to play is fine with me. And I would rather they turn that Soldier Field back into a monument or maybe raise it all together and open up the lakefront. I don't understand what is the romance and appeal of Soldier Field on the lakefront.
That's it. It's the romance of it. It's the Soldier Field on the lakefront. It's a beautiful skyline shot. It's the weather that rolls in. I know. You could actually change your background on your Zoom. You're getting your violin out.
That say they're in a city and they're not in a city. So just as a outside looking in, a new guy to Chicago, I mean, I've been here 5 years. I feel like if you're the Chicago Bears, you should be in Chicago. I ain't been to a Bears game. So, I mean, on that point, I'll watch it on TV regardless. But it feels kind of weird to be like, well, it's in Arlington Heights, technically.
Everybody's pointing out to me, San Francisco, we can start the list of teams that aren't in the town that they purport to be from.
New York Giants. I mean, I thought when they rehabbed Soldier Field back in, I think, 2002, and I thought that was a mistake. They kind of desecrated the monument, the soldiers' monument there, dropped the spaceship in the middle of it. They could have and should have gone to a place on the west side, a neighborhood that needed the development, that would have had plenty of parking and been easy to get to, but they didn't. They wanted their spot on the lakefront so that the blimp could show the Skyliners. I don't know why they wanted to be there. And I think it's inevitable that the Bears will leave. Their lease runs until, I believe, 2033. But
yeah,
it may be. I mean, I was saying last week that I thought this was just a poker play on their part, that they just want to get more favorable terms. That still may be true. But I can really see that they just say find another place to play. That stadium is small. I think it's the smallest one in the NFL, and it's not really suited to the modern needs of a city. So
I don't know why we care about that. I don't know why we care about how much revenue they can make or how many fans can be in the stands. The Bears, as they are now, are a multi-billion-dollar franchise. If they moved to Arlington Heights and had all these other revenue streams and opportunities, by one estimate, they would be the most valuable sports franchise. It's not like they're in jeopardy. It's not like we got to do the McCaskies a solid here and help them out.
So the only thing I would say is they should not get a dime of city tax money. They shouldn't get a dime of state tax money. And the reason is sort of very exactly what Eric said. Like they took advantage of the city and the state the first time, and now look where we're at. You've created this precedent and this moral hazard, where at any time they could say, hey, we're going to leave. You better give us some goodies. And the city, for whatever reason, maybe they want to keep associated tax revenue, or if it's just a pride thing, may in fact pony it up. And it's the exact same thing that happens with McCormick Place, just right next door, where it's a total albatross for the city. For 30 years, convention attendance has been declining. And they say, we need more money to operate. And the city, and it goes deeper and deeper and deeper into debt. And you could see the same thing happening with the Bears at Soldier Field if the city keeps pouring in money.
I'm very intrigued by the gambling aspect, sports betting. Rivers Casino, they made that deal with the Bears. I'm sure that's got to play a factor as well with the sports betting, because you see the Cubs make their move with the sports betting agency they worked with. But it's becoming a thing where a lot more sports teams are trying to ally themselves with that. Control that space.
Speaking of the Cubs, you know, at least the Ricketts spent their own money to improve Wrigley Field, to buy the properties around there, develop them on their own dime. I suppose the city's in for a little here and there, but that's pretty much a private enterprise. I don't know if that's a model for any of these other teams, if it's reasonable to expect that a NFL franchise could shoulder all of the costs, but maybe it is. The Ricketts have put – how much – was it $600 million that I'm thinking of? No, that sounds high. It was some fantastic sum of money that the Ricketts put in to improve Wrigley Field and to develop the blocks around Wrigley Field, much to the benefit, I think, of that community. I think it's a bit better space for it. All right. Well, that'll pretty much wrap it up today. Does anybody want to offer any last bits of advice for Eric on his last column? I think he could still get – you know, a shout out to the Mincing Rascals, which that's what I miss every now and then. He does put a shout out to the Rascals in his column. I guess we're going to lose that, huh, Eric?
I'll see if I can do a freelance pitch for the Rascals every few weeks.
Well, are you going to include us at the very end of yours, or is this awkward, Austin, to ask him that question? But you can still hear me on the Mincing Rascals, which drops Thursdays.
I put that in a lot of times at the end, and a lot of times they trim it. So. And sometimes they don't, other times. It's like, it seems to be what the editor's feeling like.
After all the love this podcast gives the Tribune, and sometimes we get cut out of their space. How do you like that?
We'll put it in, John. We'll see what happens.
Okay. Good luck, Eric. Brandon, Austin, thanks, guys.
See you guys next week.
See you.
That's the Mincing Rascals with Eric Zorn, Austin Burke, and Brandon Pope. We're produced by Ashley Byhun and Elif Garris. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.